Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you here with us. We are about to have a conversation around housing policy in the city, something we've been covering here intensely since 1993 on the Mark Steiner Show. Last week, we had Peter Engel, who was, as we all know, a fairly straight shooter in the housing department, talking about what's going to happen to the future of Perkins Homes. One of my guests, Dr. Lawrence Brown, was here, and in a very interesting back and forth with Peter Engel on some of the issues, joins us once again. And so one of the questions I posed to Peter Engel that day was a concern that if you move Perkins housing residents out of their homes while you do whatever you're going to do, rebuild it, rehab it, whatever they're doing to Perkins homes, they say they have no idea, then you were going to put them in all these other very poor black neighborhoods, committing the same segregation over and over and over again that we started with redlining. So Barbara Samuels, who is the chief of housing attorney at the ACLU, sent me a note saying that that it is not correct that HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department cabinet in D.C., requires choice neighborhoods replacement housing to be built within the target neighborhoods. In other words, they could be built in. People could move to Canton. They could move to Fells Point. They could move to Harbor East. They could move to any catchment area around where there's wealth and good housing, not just in neighborhoods where people are struggling to survive. So why is that, and what does that mean? And then we've seen the news that of what happened in Baltimore with the removal of people who were living in a homeless encampment, and now we are beautifying those areas and fencing them off and creating a new world, that means that you can't camp and live there if you don't feel like going to a shelter that's full of all kinds of nasty things you don't want to be sleeping with. And then the third thing is we see President Barack Obama talking about we have to end housing segregation and what policies do to that. But those things can be conflated, actually, in some ways, to discussion about the future of housing in our city, which we are going to have today. And as part of that discussion, we have, once again, Dr. Lawrence Brown is here in the studio, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy here at Morgan State University. Good to have you back, Lawrence, as always.
Always a pleasure.
Always love when you're behind the mic and I'm not here. It's always a good show.
I just try to hold it down.
Jeff Singer is with us, founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless. And Teddy Maddox joins us, member of the Faces of Homelessness Speakers Bureau, who slept along the Falls Way for some time. Good to have you. Welcome to the show, Teddy.
Well, thank you for having me.
410-319-8888 is the number here, so please join us, 410-319-8888. You can write to us, talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me, @MarkSteiner. Log on to our Facebook pages, but do call 410-319-8888. One of the things you can comment and think about is we've had many debates in this program around the question of housing, but more than that, about black and white community and whether integration is important or not in society, or desegregation is important in society. They're two different things. And what it would mean if we opened neighborhoods up in this town so that they were racially and economically integrated. What does that mean? Is that what we want or not? And what would that entail? 410-319-8888. So, really want to hear your thoughts. But let's start here with our panelists. And so to me, that was really interesting that I had this back and forth with Peter Engel on this question. And you remember that. You were here, mm-hmm. Lawrence. And so in what it means in terms of the mindset and thinking that says when you move people out of Perkins Homes, quote unquote, temporarily, while they do something to Perkins Homes, which you don't know what that means yet, mm-hmm. that they're going to be moved to other poor black neighborhoods rather than to surrounding places like Little Italy, Fells Point, Canton, Harbor East. What are your thoughts? Because to me, it's like a direct descendant of the redlining, which is where we began all this. So the segregation of 1911.
Right. Well, my thing is, number one, the plan is to apply for the Choice Neighborhoods program, a part of HUD, which is a direct descendant of Hope 6. And Hope 6, under Hope 6, the Clinton Initiative, there were 250,000 public housing units demolished. Choice Neighborhoods, as Ed Getz talks about in his book, New Deal Ruins, plans to demolish another 285,000. Then on alongside of all this, we have RAD, the Rental Assistance Demonstration, which is privatizing public housing. In Baltimore, we're selling off our remaining 22 high-rises to private nonprofit entities, if I'm not mistaken. And so what we're seeing is, and then if you step even further back, Congress is constantly defunding public housing. And so that's the, I think, policy environment in which we're looking at what's going on with Perkins Homes. We're trying to understand, as they move forward with this plan, where do the residents fit in? How will residents have a voice? And indeed, how will they actually go about displacing people, and where will they end up?
And what is your sense of this, Jeff? You've been involved in fair housing and housing for poor working people in this town for 30 years, 40 years more.
I'm very old, yes.
I did not say that.
But it's true. And thank you, Dr. Brown, for a really good summary
thank you.
Of
Absolutely.
The policy environment. And by the way, some of those RAD developers are for-profit ones, too. Let me provide another facet of this interesting problem, which is the demographics in Baltimore as relates to housing and income. You know, there are – you know I like numbers. There are 238,959, let's say 240,000 households in Baltimore, right? 98,000 of them can't pay their rent every month. Or if they are mortgage holders, can't afford their mortgage. 98,000, 42.5% of all of the households in Baltimore.
Where does that come from?
You know where this comes from? It comes from the Baltimore City Housing and Community Development Department. Isn't that wonderful? They published a really useful document. They publish it every 5 years, their consolidated plan. And the newest consolidated plan is both interesting, edifying, and horrifying all at the same time. It has great data in it. And I'm just going to give you a few more numbers. So there's 98,000 households that can't afford their housing costs every month. Of those, 61,000, almost 62,000, are extremely poor. 62,000 households in Baltimore are extremely poor. And of those, 45,000 can't pay their housing costs every month. And what are we doing about it? All right. So in this draft consolidated plan, it tells us what the city of Baltimore is doing about this enormous problem. It's creating 979 units of affordable housing in the next 5 years. In the next 5 years. Now, that's a little bit under 1% of what we need. And let me provide an analogy. There are approximately 85,000 public school students in Baltimore. Would we ever say that only 850 of them deserve a quality education? Would we ever say that?
Well,
of course we wouldn't. But only 1% of the folks who live in Baltimore deserve quality housing? That's the official city policy.
So what do you think, folks? 410-319-8888, and what is our way around that? I want to come to that, but let me add the other element here that was part of this, which was closing down. Just want to cover a couple of things, come back and get into this in greater depth. Closing down the places where people who are homeless in the city are camped. And we've covered this a lot, Camp 83 and more over the years. And many people have said, we're camping here because we find the shelters unsafe, that it's unsafe for women and children, that they are bug bedridden. Nobody wants to be in there, lice infested. Nobody wants to be in these places. And they're just smelly and nasty. And they are smelly and nasty when I've been in there. They're not. So, but let me hear, and let me ask you, if you would, Teddy Maddox, just talk about that experience while you stayed outside on the street and what your experiences were in those shelters.
I've only been in the shelter for a week. I stayed in there a week. It was poor maintenance, unprofessional staffing. You had no real directions in there. And I'd rather stay in the streets than to stay in a place of that magnitude, because it was no real conducive elements in that where I could transition from homelessness, you know, to having a home. They provided none of that. So most of my experience came from outside. I didn't have all that over my head. And in the direction I wished to take, it was right there for me, healthcare for the homeless. And through them, I've been able to gain everything, just about. I'm not completely satisfied, but I'm better off than I was.
Right.
And also, I've had an opportunity to reconnect with the advocacies, as well as I've excel to a member, a board member of HCH. It's been a plus for me, and I hope that other people will try the same methods, you know, not stand in the streets and give yourself a break.
So what was the difference for you, just real quick, Tay, before we turn back here? What was the difference? Can you describe what the difference was living in an encampment versus living in a shelter? How did it feel? What was how the experiences were different?
You felt more entrusted in the encampments as opposed to the shelter. The shelter, it was just you had to do what you had to do to survive in there. Mm. It was like you said, it was a nasty situation. The attitudes in there was nasty. The conditions were nasty. Everything was just nasty. The way they served food, the way they talked to you, the way they would treat you, and out in encampments, everybody was family. Everybody was close knitted. You didn't have to worry about the piss poor attitudes because everybody was focusing on the same thing, just about
survival.
Thank you. So it was more conducive to be out than in, you know. For me, it felt like it was being in prison, in a shelter. Everybody wanted to run something. Everybody wanted to be the master. Everybody wanted to be the boss. Nobody wanted to be the Indians.
So, but in the community that was built of people without homes that lived in tents and other places under bridges and parts of Baltimore City, it sounded like you were describing a place that was kind of more of a, I mean, I know every place has issues and there are arguments and things happen between people, but you're describing a place that was much more collective and communal, yes, and looking out for each other. And
yes, that was the number one key. You had to look out for each other in that small community. In that large community, you only had to look out for one person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was yourself. Or you was going to drown in the madness. So out there, I would prefer to be out there where everybody's watching over each other as opposed to being in the jungle.
I would say, Teddy Max, it was very poetically said. I appreciate it. No, I mean, I think people need to hear that because, you know, most people in the city with homes that they're paying mortgages for or rents or whatever, living down in Mount Vernon or over here in Northwood where we are, don't even have a sense of what it means, Lawrence, to be homeless, to be in that world, and how many of our fellow citizens live like that, thousands of them every day. Thousands.
Absolutely. And, you know, a lot of this is really, because we look at Baltimore City, we know it's about 66% black. And the racialized policies that have contributed to the type of dire housing situation that we're hearing described right now. And it was 105 years of that, starting with racial zoning in 1910, then progressing to restrictive covenants in 1918 when you had the Roland Park Company and Edward Bowden pioneer restrictive covenants, and Baltimore pioneered racial zoning. Then you had segregated public housing in the city in 1937, and redlining also take place, which was sponsored by federal government and produced by the Homeowners Loan Corporation and the Federal Housing Administration. So you have the confluence of these factors, and Douglas Massey says, a sociologist, I believe, at Princeton, that Baltimore is not just a segregated city, but a hyper-segregated city in the top 8 hyper-segregated cities in the United States of America. And so what we're talking about is these policies that engender and recreate and enforce poverty. The extreme poverty that Jeff Singer talked about, those are produced in these policies, and we've never done anything in this city to undo that segregation and to undo the sort of forced displacement that we do. And I think the encampment is a part of that legacy. Gentrification is rapidly becoming a part of that. There's a development that's going to be built in Hose Heights, which I fear will displace that historically black community near Roland Park. Then you got Sharp Leadenhall near 395 down near Fells Federal Hill. And that community is threatened by, I think, encroachment. And so we're talking about mass foreclosures, the dismantling of public housing, these pressures and forces, policy forces, which are pushing people out as well as keeping them contained in these redlined, disinvested communities. So when we talk about Perkins Homes, we have to talk about it in the context of all these things that are going on and have historically taken place.
So, folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts. I mean, I want to really wrestle with all of you about this idea. How do we reinvent this policy? What do we do now? What opportunities are we confronted with at the moment that allow us maybe build a different way of dealing with housing? I think everything, every struggle, every kind of barrier is fraught with possibility and fraught with the possible of doing something better and different. How do we do that? How do you think we do that? At 410-319-8888. Before we go to break, I'll read this tweet, then we'll come right back to our guest. But do join us, 410-319-8888. Dan Freeman tweeted us, at Mark Steiner. He said, in Baltimore County, for example, the government wanted affordable housing, but the people didn't. People can't change that. We as a society have moved too far to the right, and the middle is now the left. So that's what Dan Freeman says. So we will see. We'll wrestle with that when we come back. So we'll take a very short break. Come right back with your thoughts and ideas at 410-319-8888. We want to hear what you have to say. And we are going to break with Aretha Franklin singing the Star-Spangled Banner on this day in 1992 at the Democratic National Convention. We'll be right back.
We hail at the twilight's last gleaming, the world's broad stripe, and bright stars through the perilous fight. Oh, the rampers we were so gay.
A mighty hard road that my poor hand is hold. My poor feet has traveled a hot, dusty road. Out of your dust bowl.
Welcome back. That's Pastors of Plenty by Woody Guthrie, the great troubadour of the working class, born this day in 1912. I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Reminding you here that on Thursday, July 23rd, 2015, the statewide work group on public safety and policing established by the legislative leaders in Annapolis is hosting a town hall meeting from 4 to 8 p.m. The public will offer testimony on challenges, concerns, and opportunities to improve police-community relations, police training and hiring, and community engagement across Maryland. The town hall will be held in the Legislative Services Building at 90 State Circle in Annapolis. That's July 23rd for the community to have their voice heard in Annapolis. We're here now with Dr. Lawrence Brown, Jeff Singer, and Teddy Maddox talking about housing. Please join us at 410-319-8888. So what opportunities does this present to us here? I mean, you have Perkins Homes. I mean, when were you on the show last with the housing department? I hated that when I said that, with the HCD, Housing Community Development. they said, I think if I have this correct, they were saying there is no plan yet. Right?
That's what they said.
Mm-hmm. We don't know if there's a plan. But we do know that whatever the plan is, that people are going to be moved out, quote unquote, temporarily while they deal with Perkins Homes. So what opportunities does this leave us? I mean, what would happen if the push was that people who live in Perkins Homes would have the availability to move to Inner Harbor East, Fells Point, Little Italy, Canton, and then debate on what happens and figure out what happens next with the area that is now Perkins Homes. What? Give us some possible scenarios from you three gentlemen's minds about what might happen.
Well, I have, if you don't mind, a few that we could discuss. And Pastures of Plenty by Woody Guthrie is a great way to lead into this, because there's a lot of capital, money, that circulates through not only Baltimore as a whole, but our really poor neighborhoods. Housing Our Neighbors, our homeless advocacy group, has done a survey of vacant houses in McKeldry Park, small neighborhood, 15 square blocks. This is hard to believe. $55 million has circulated through one of the poorest neighborhoods in the United States, $55 million, in the buying and selling of houses, 59% of which are vacant, the buying and selling of these houses. And not a penny of that has benefited the people who live there. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of capital. So to answer your question, what if we ended speculation in housing? Housing became a right and a utility rather than a way for people to make money. What if that $55 million had actually been invested in McKeldry Park? What difference would that make? Now, let's translate that to Perkins Homes. Let's end the speculation of housing in the Perkins Homes area. Let's have the people who live there currently own the land as a community land trust, operate it in a democratic and participatory fashion, and prevent anyone from ever using it to make money, but rather to make a place that people want to live in and that creates for them a decent life. What would that be like?
And I think, you know, help alongside that, which I absolutely agree with, alongside that, help has come from the most unlikely of sources, the Supreme Court, which just affirmed or kept, you know, the Fair Housing Act of 1968 alive, although they slightly weakened it, but the disparate impact clause is still there. But what may be alongside that very important is, I believe, a week after that, last week, I think even while we were on the air, HUD released the affirmatively fair housing rule, or a rule to affirmatively further fair housing, which is tremendously important because the affirmatively further clause has been in the fair housing law the whole time, but it's never been enforced. Never. Until now, where they finally put a policy together in this rule that says, and I think actually strengthens our ability to hold the Housing Authority of Baltimore City accountable in the way that they go about implementing this and any other plan. So for Perkins Homes, I would say yes, keep them where they are because they're already in a up-and-coming or wealthy community. No need to move them. Keep them right where they are. Let them have control of that land, control of that property, redevelop it. They're already in a wealthy community. No need to move them. But if you're looking at a place like Gilmore Homes, you're looking at some of these other like McCullough Homes, which depending on what happens with the State Center, that could be an up-and-coming community too. But if the governor says no to the State Center, then that's going to remain a challenged community. And so what I'm thinking is, alongside keeping people in wealthy communities, is reverse gentrifying. We need to allow poor people who choose to move to Roland Park, to move to Guilford, to move to Homeland, and build public housing in those communities, because those were the communities that created these exclusionary policies. Those were the communities where segregation was intentionally created to keep out poor black people, because the fear was it would reduce their housing values. And so it's only poetic justice to say, Roland Park, we're going to put public housing in your community. And those that want to move there, if people don't want to, they shouldn't be forced. But those that want to go, they should have a home in Roland Park. They should have a home in Guilford, in Canton, in Northwood, in these historically green-lined communities.
But what do you think, folks? How do we get there? Is this the place we want to go? 410-319-8888. I think housing will be front and center as one of the issues, along, of course, they're going to be pushing crime and murders in Baltimore as a major issue in this election coming up. But housing is one of the key issues around all of this that will be in this 2016 election. What are your thoughts on where this needs to go? 410-319-8888 to join in this conversation. But can we – I just want to take another digression, because I just want to make sure we get this on the table, and I want to understand, because I just kind of went over it fairly quickly. If Jeff and Teddy could talk about the landscaping, what the mayor and others are doing with landscaping in the homeless encampments.
Well, Teddy's asked me to start. I'll start. But then we'll hear from the real expert. The city for some years now, since 2010 in any event, has had an overt policy of destroying the places where people who experience homelessness have made a home because they can't find a decent place to live. So people, as Teddy described, have created communities. Those communities are outside, sometimes under a bridge. And the city is destroying them and has been. The day before the Martin Luther King Day parade of 2010, the city destroyed the encampment on Martin Luther King Boulevard so that marchers would not see that there were poor and homeless people in Baltimore. They purposely did this. Martin Luther King Jr. himself said that one of the greatest crimes we commit is hiding the poor and pushing them to the margin, and the city proved that on his day. Then they destroyed that encampment again 2 weeks ago, knowing that the people there had nowhere to go, knowing the people had nowhere to go. There's no room in any of the shelters, nor do most people who stay outside want to go to a shelter for lots of good reasons. Wonderful essay in The Brew last week about the encampment at St. Vincent's Park, which, by the way, has just been closed. But in 2005, Martin O'Malley gave Healthcare for the Homeless money to hire a full-time social worker. She wrote the essay in The Brew. And apartments for every single person who lived in the park. And in 9 months, everyone was housed. And most of them, 85%, are still housed. And out of that came the city's so-called commitment to the Housing First approach, which is, if someone's homeless, what that person needs is a home. And the Housing First approach is to say, okay, we'll find you a home. We'll make sure you can afford it. If there are other services you need, we'll provide it. And guess what? You're not homeless anymore. That really works. But the city's no longer using that approach. So now they're destroying encampments, and they're trying to destroy the one under the Jones Falls on the Fallsway.
Near Healthcare for the Homeless.
Yes, and they've announced that on August 8th, they will begin landscaping the area, landscaping the new euphemism for displacement, for encampment destruction. And frankly, we're fighting it. And I would invite all of your listeners to call 396-3100 and express to the mayor that this retrograde policy of displacing poor and homeless people must end. And the city must create new affordable housing opportunities so people can get off the street and find new dignity in their lives.
Do you want to add to that, Teddy?
My first thought would be, how do you landscape concrete? But
you can drop the mic.
But how do you landscape concrete? But the thing of it all, I agree with Jeff. The displacement of people, you know, that are trying to desperately to get back into the process of recovery in life, it just hinders and hurts, you know, every effort that a person puts up. You know, you push me to the point where I lose all hope, you know, because everything I try to do, a door closes in my face, you know. So you just push me and push me and push me until I'm forced to do something that may get me not the right housing, but housed.
Mm-hmm. And that is the key component mm-hmm. right there, in which housing actually is a root cause of crime. The lack of housing is, we're talking about crime. We're talking about the spike of homicidal violence in our city. Well, apartheid policies lead to social pathologies. If you have people that are getting foreclosed, evicted, you know, demolishing their encampments, then you're creating the conditions and the anger that's going to create crime. And I think that's the something that our policymakers are totally, not, I wouldn't say ignorant, they're choosing, that's willful neglect. They're willfully neglecting that link that he just described perfectly.
So, Fox, this is a call to action. I think people need to think about where we have to go and make some moves and have voices heard in this town. Put your voices on the air right now at 410-319-8888. Kim, line one, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Kim. How are you?
I'm doing well, sir. You know, this whole encampment issue is really, really disturbing. Two Fridays ago, the city cleared the encampment at Martin Luther King. And what we heard in a meeting of providers last week was that numerous providers had empty beds that evening. And the city doesn't know on any given day the number of bed space available in shelters and transitional homes and emergency facilities. And that's unconscionable because they could have put those people up who wanted to get off the street. that Friday evening. But they made no effort, no attempt whatsoever to connect those people to resources and programs. And this whole government system of homeless services sucks. It really sucks. They do nothing to serve these people. These providers are taking money. They're not providing the connections, the counseling, the intensive case management that a lot of these people need. We know that there are barriers that these individuals have to connecting to homeless services. You know, they don't have enough income. They may have mental health challenges. They may have substance abuse issues. But the city and the system that's set up doesn't do anything to provide a pathway for them. It's terrible.
Jim, this is Kim Chuhart, I know, who is one of the leading advocates down at City Hall all the time fighting these issues. Kim, I appreciate the thoughts. And anybody want to comment on what Kim was saying?
Well, that there is a homeless services industry that's developed over the last 30 years is a real indictment of the United States and our public policies. Having said that, I don't think it's the homeless service providers that cause or perpetuate homelessness. It's that we don't have affordable housing. It's that people are very, very poor. We don't have sufficient services for folks. Our addiction treatment services are completely inadequate. And the homeless services industry is not really complicit in that. We would like to end the homeless services industry. There needn't be one at all. If we had a distribution of wealth that made sense, if every goal in the United States was not to make money for somebody, if we distributed wealth in a reasonable way and had a real democratic functioning society, we don't. So if we – those fundamental changes are not the fault of the homeless services industry, but – let's end the homeless services industry. I agree with Ms. Kent.
Right. And to do that, we have to have affordable housing for people to live in.
Yep.
In this community. 410-319-8888. Sunday, line 2, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm originally from Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
If you're on welfare or homeless in Hawaii, each year there's a lottery. And anyone who wants to can put their name in that lottery. And the state of Hawaii will give you a home, not an apartment, not Section 8, not public housing. We don't have much of that. They will give you a home. They give you classes to teach you how to cut your grass, how to get your trash out, and how to do minor maintenance on your home. But you have a home that you don't have to pay a mortgage on. It actually saves money. The second thing is, several years ago, I didn't have much money. So my gift to charity was to go down to Jones Falls Expressway and pick two women and bring them to my home and allow them to shower and wash their clothes. And not the same two women every time, but two different women every time. And these are the stories they told me. First of all, about 90% of homeless people get food stamps and they get cash. Okay, and that the people who were in the camp at Jones Falls Expressway had addictions or mental illnesses of some kind. The people who had addictive personalities did not want to spend any of their money, either of the food stamps, which they normally sold, or the cash they received, on housing, because then they could not spend it on the addiction. And the mental health people, the homeless services, did not have adequate service for them so that they could get the help they needed. Well, the stories, and it was a total of maybe 20 women, because I did it like for 6 months, and the stories they told me indicted both the homeless industry and the city of Baltimore for not providing the adequate services that they knew the people needed. And the fear of sleeping in the homeless shelters is real. They spoke of rape. They spoke of theft.
Right.
They spoke of knifings. And I'd like to know why there's not security in the shelters so that people feel secure living in them and not have to live on the street.
Sandy, thanks for that. Let's take each one of the two things that she focused on. One was the fact that some of the homeless, many homeless people are addicted and mentally ill, and that this affects the money they use, and they use it inadequately and incorrectly. What are our thoughts about that? Before we turn to the whole question of why we can't reform our shelters, can anybody speak to that?
Well, I mean, I would say that, you know, we got people in Roland Park, Guilford, and Homeland that are addicted too, and you know, so I don't think that's any indictment on folk who are homeless and maybe, you know, using their money on substances. But, you know, people are, I think, fundamentally from a public health perspective, they may be using that those substances to cope. They may be using those substances to help them deal with the situation that they're in. Like she said, they've been raped, knifed, you know, abused. So who knows what traumas are underlying, you know, the issue behind the substance use. And so that's what I think. We have to get to the root and stop judging people necessarily for the behavior, because ultimately drug use is a public health issue. But we treat it more as we put a stigma on it, and then we incarcerate people because of it. And I think that's what we have to get away from.
And the question is raised about the homeless shelters. I mean, who runs these shelters? The city?
No.
Who runs them?
Private nonprofits run them.
And so why can't they be controlled? Well, you know, I've seen some good ones. Like I went to Lutheran, is it Lutheran Church down in right by the Inner Harbor? Mm-hmm. That's mostly for women and children. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went there and I spent time there. Clearly, a beautiful place, very safe. Women and children have a place to live, beds to live in, rooms to work in, food to cook together, skills to learn. And so they can work if we work in a different way.
Sure, you've seen one shelter, you've seen one shelter. I mean, there are wonderful shelters. Project Place, probably my favorite shelter. It's been around for 40 years. It's a great place. The big city shelter, it's called the City Shelter. It's run by Associated Catholic Charities on the Falls Way. It's a very large place, and I suppose there's over 200 people there every night. It's probably difficult to maintain it.
When I walked through there years back, that particular shelter reminded me of a prison in the South, where there was just cots wall to wall. And that's what it felt like.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think what we're missing here, man, is that it is a lack of communication. It is a lack of communication between the policymakers and the advocacies that can assist the people that's in the encampments. If you went through 80, if you went under 83, they had posted down there under the on the poles down there that if we are to move any encampment here, we are to provide transportation for them, we are to provide a place to put their clothing, and we are to provide a shelter for them to go to. But here recently, they have been just kicked out. Even those are their own words, and it is posted on various posts under 83.
I mean, those are things that we do not see and do not hear in the press. 410-319-8888, line 3, A-Rod, you're on the air.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
Very well, welcome.
Good, and I'd like to say hello to your guest as well. It's a very important and well-needed conversation about housing. And Mark, you know, I'm an avid listener. I rarely call in, but I wanted to just call in this time because, you know, for 9 years I was a real estate developer. And one of the things that's interesting about being in real estate development, many times real estate developers are forced to address the issue of affordable housing. And usually we have to address it through some sort of development as part of our development formula. When I was doing development, so some communities, there was a requirement for a certain amount of affordable housing. In other communities, there wasn't necessarily a requirement, but it was almost always a consideration. What was interesting and fascinating was that I don't ever remember sitting in a development meeting on any of the projects we ever worked on, most of them multi-million dollar projects, where homelessness was raised as an issue. And I think that it's important that somehow during the process, whether it's by state mandate or city mandate, that I think that I'm not putting the responsibility on developers, because this is a community approach and a community effort, and it's a community problem. We got to solve it as community, right? But that developers, I think, should be included more in what the solution should look like for addressing these core issues of homelessness. And one thing in particular, before I go, I'm going to say this, is that suppose that, you know, folks, you know, want to open a homeless shelter. I don't even know if there's a path that folks know how to open a homeless shelter without taking on, let's say, the legal issues that could come with the potential legal issues that could come with opening a homeless shelter.
Well, and I think opening a homeless shelter, it really depends on how they run and how small they are and how adequate they are. And I think that the biggest issue here is we need to open, as other people have been saying, housing. Housing has to be open for people who are homeless, so people have a place to stay, so that if we are building buildings, there have to be rooms or whatever for people who are homeless to have a place to live, to have a roof over their heads. And there's really no reason not to have that in our community. Mayor tweeted in, a homeless industrial complex, question mark. Kevin responded to his tweet saying, it sometimes seems that way. Yes, it exists, and it's still insufficient for the need. We must reinvest in housing. Kevin also had tweeted in, Linda tweeted in earlier, that MLK himself lamented that we hide the poor and the marginalized, and the city destroyed an encampment on MLK Boulevard. I think he was quoting you, Jeff Singer. I'm curious what you think that how Obama's announcement will affect housing policy in the city and this country. What will that with his announcement of trying to end legalized segregation? How will that change things, if any? And also, given that within that there are also the devastating cuts to housing on the federal level. From the federal housing department. How do we think that's going to change things?
Well, there's a year and a half left to his presidency. So depending on who's elected in 2016, this rule can be overturned. So I think there's an urgency to push this affirmatively furthering fair housing rule that HUD has put out as far as we can, as fast as we can, and then push like hell to make sure that we get a candidate that will keep this rule so then we can – you know, none of the developers or the HABC, the Housing Authority of Baltimore City, they can't just sit back and say, well, we'll just wait till Obama's gone. So my thing is, you know, there are some really powerful things in here. So the community, my hope is that the Housing Roundtable, United Workers, and some of the people that are really working on this issue, Housing Our Neighbors, the group with Jessica Lewis, I can't remember the name now.
Right to Housing Alliance.
Yeah, that we'd all sit down and say, how do we maximize this rule so that we can maximize and optimize outcomes for people in Perkins homes and in other places around the city that have been affected by the policies of the Housing Authority of Baltimore City?
Any other thoughts?
I always have thoughts, Mark. I hope that we don't confuse a civil right with an economic, political, and social right, and with actual policies and programs that implement it. So that people have the right to live in a neighborhood, that a poor person who lives in McKeldry Park or in Santa Winchester has the right to live in Roland Park, that's good, that's important. But they don't have the money to do so. There aren't public subsidies available to do so. And until we change that equation, I want to focus on creating the opportunities, creating the actual housing, and where we put it, people democratically should determine that.
And I think to extend that, you know, the budget for our police is $444 million, almost half a billion. I think it is half a billion now. This might be 2013 data that I'm looking at. But the police budget is more than health, housing, arts, and parks and recreation combined. So we virtually have a police state because our Baltimore City budget is designed to police people more than it is to give them health, housing, arts, and parks. And so I think we've got to – I would cut at least $100 million right off the bat from that police budget and say, let's go into housing, let's go into health, and let's begin to invest in creating the housing, building it, and then making sure that we're desegregating Baltimore as we go along the way. We should be demilitarizing and defunding our police. We should not be spending $500 million on our police and more than these other services combined. That's just insane.
And we've talked about that before, and I think that would be an interesting way to have a debate on this program about the city budget. It would be an interesting way to approach that.
Yeah, speaking of the city budget, if housing people who are experiencing homelessness is a priority for the city, why is it that the entire general fund budget of the city for permanent housing for people who are homeless is $716,000. $716,000. That's what the city contributes. Now, the federal government contributes more, $23 million, which is going down, by the way. It's less than last year. But the city's own priority, because budgets are policy,
yes.
right? $716,000, which is three times what they provided last year.
It was only three times.
It was only $200,000 last year. It'll be $700,000.
Right.
Clearly, it's not a priority.
Right. And budgets are values as well. They're expressions of values. So we value policing more than we do housing. We value policing more than we do health. Although, if you don't have health and you don't have housing, you're going to need more police. So you're better off investing more in those services up front.
I have a lot of questions here, but we have run out of time in this particular segment. There's a tweet from Kevin we'll finish off with. He said, if shelters are run by nonprofits, are there any regulations as how they are to be run? If there are, who checks the regulations that are followed? That's a question. I don't think we know very much about that because I've not seen much inspection going on in a really serious way in our shelters. But we have places to jump off from here. We've invited the HCD to come back in the program, so we can continue this conversation with them and our guests here. And I think that we could talk about what a city budget can look like at some point in the future. It's another conversation I have on the air here. And I want to thank all of our guests for being here in the studio. Dr. Lawrence Brown, Jeff Singer, Teddy Maddox. Good to have the three of you here. Thank you so much. Good
Always.
To meet you, Teddy.
Thanks so much.
And we're going to take a very brief break here and come right back. We're going to tackle a bunch of things that are really interesting to talk about. So do not leave us. We're going out with Black Eyed Peas and Macy Gray, Taboo of Black Eyed Peas, born on this day in 1975. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Chief Sewell, a black police chief thrown out of office in Pocomoke City. What happened there? Delegate Joe Carter, Stephen Janis, and he will be joining us to talk about that. And then we will be joined by Kavitha Davidson and Dave Zirin to talk about women in sports, the World Cup, also what is happening with Serena Williams and all this incredibly weird blowback because of about her body and who she is. We'll get into all that coming up. Stay with us. Don't go away.
Song on the radio, so I call and request it on the radio. Tell the DJ, spin it over mix show. Make a brother feel like I'm down at the disco. And we're gonna keep it going like this.